Here at Early Excellence, we specialise in early childhood education. We offer expert advice and guidance through training, consultancy and classroom design. With the Early Excellence podcast, we aim to inspire and support you as well as challenge your thinking. So if that's what you're looking for, you've come to the right place. Hello everybody, Andy Burt here. We're taking a break from recording new episodes of the podcast at the minute, but we will be back with new Early Excellence podcast episodes in September. Until then, we'll be re-releasing some of our favourite episodes from the year so far. So here's my Early Excellence podcast chat with Dr. Jules Page as we explore professional love in the early years. Jules, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. How are you? You okay?
Hi, Andy. Nice to meet you. Yeah, I'm very well. Thank you.
Great. Great to see you. We're going to talk about something that I know is very close to your heart, and that is professional love. Something that I know you've done a lot of research into, and it's something, as I say, that's very close to your heart. Just before we get on to talking about that, could you give us an introduction into your work? Would that be okay?
Yeah, absolutely, Andy. I'd be delighted. So as you said, my name is Dr. Jules Page, and I'm an early years researcher working at the University of Brighton currently. Prior to that, I was at the University of Sheffield for 9 years. And before I became an academic, I worked in a variety of roles within early years. So, for example, I've worked for a local authority. I've also worked in early years practice. I managed a day nursery for 10 years and a holiday play scheme. And I've been a nanny. So I've been in all sorts of early years professional roles. And I feel it's still a privilege to be able to work with and alongside children and families. And so to be able to research in this field has been an absolute joy and something that I hope that I'll be able to do for a long time to come.
Fantastic. Thank you. So professional love then. Tell us about how your interest or how the work started on professional love. You know, where did that begin? Where did the journey begin for you?
Thanks, Andy. So yeah, so for me, the journey began long before I ever coined the phrase professional love. And it began in my practice back in the days when I probably didn't know as much about theory as I do now, and certainly didn't know as much about the importance of theory. But what I've come to understand is that theory is so, so important in terms of linking it to how we work with children and families every day. And so it's so closely related to practice. But what I found that I was doing, as I say, when I was a very newly qualified practitioner, I was working closely with children and families, and I was making relationships with them that seemed to come to me quite naturally and normally. But they seemed to be boundaried and different from the relationships that I had in my own family setup. And it wasn't until years later, and I could give many examples of what that looked like, that I began to realize that there was something quite special about those relationships. And there was something around permissions from parents, but also from children, that I couldn't quite articulate at that time. And when I've always been interested in the youngest children in society, I think they're the ones that really I feel are probably the most marginalized in many ways by just by the fact that they're the youngest, a bit like the older people in society. And I was always fascinated by the things in which babies can do. They're not boring by any stretch of the imagination, even though some people might think that they are. And so I really enjoyed working with the babies and the toddlers. But it wasn't really until I carried out my PhD that I started to really look at this in depth. So in research terms, and I'm sure you know about this, Andy, from your previous guests, for example, that often when you're carrying out research, you tend to choose something that is closely related to your own ontology and epistemology. So because I was a working mother and I went back to work when my children were very young, I was really interested to know what other mothers were interested in when they were looking for early years and childcare services. So my PhD really investigated mothers' views about going back to work when their babies were under a year old. I wanted to know what they were looking for. Were they looking for you know, outstanding Ofsted reports? Were they looking for particular curriculum and particular philosophies and so on and so forth? I had a hunch that they were looking for the quality of relationships. And of course, the literature that had gone before was really important in that regard. My theoretical framework is situated within Bowlby's attachment theory. I'm a strong advocate for attachment theory, but I think we have to critique the ways in which Bowlby carried out his research back in the day. We have to bear that in mind. But I still feel that it's got a place in society today, and particularly within the context of early years settings. And I was also interested in Nell Nodding's ethic of care theory about relational ethics. So it was within that theoretical framework that I carried out my PhD research. They were life historical interviews. So they were only with a small number of women who were willing to talk to me for a long time about their experiences and why they chose to go back to work or not, and the challenges that they faced. And essentially out of that study, I was perhaps unsurprised, although the ways that the women presented it to me were not in the terms that I perhaps would have praised professional love, but what they were talking about seemed to resonate with the sort of experience that I'd had, both as a parent of children who had gone into nursery and also as a practitioner myself. And so it was at a time when we didn't really talk about love in earlier settings. It was very taboo. And so I coined this phrase professional love because it seemed to be more acceptable to use a phrase like that, partly to distinguish it from familial love, but also to start the dialogue, really. So after my PhD, I then, obviously that was a small sample of women, very, very important to me in terms of you know, my findings, but I wanted then to begin the journey on that, really, and find out a little bit more about what others thought about it as well.
Yeah. So that then sort of led into that work around professional love within settings then. So it's a really interesting journey, really, that those conversations that link to your own experiences as a mother, then went one step further and then in from that into the settings. Yeah, really, really interesting. So professional love then as a phrase, really interesting, I think, that you wanted to make that definition as being different to what we might call as sort of familial or parental love. Yeah, really interesting. Can you describe what you were meaning by it? You know, what you know, if you were to sort of define it or to kind of what are you meaning by it? What sorts of things are you talking about when you talk about professional love?
Thank you. Yeah, it's been quite a journey, really, with that, because for a long time I was reluctant to define it. I wanted to find out what other people thought about it. And so my subsequent research, where I was really asking the sector what they thought about it, was fascinating. But it did come to a point where folk were saying to me, come on, Jules, nail your colours to the mast. You know, we need to know what your definition is. So my definition is really bound up with a paper I wrote in 2018 around the characteristics, really, of what I consider to be professional love. So what I was really keen not to do, Andy, was to say, if you do this, 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 and this, this is what professional love is. I wanted that to be more, I suppose, it needs to be organic within the context of an early years setting. So, but there are characteristics that are really important in terms of what my definition is. So first and foremost, there has to be that triangle where you've got the child at the centre, but you've got the practitioner, the teacher, the educator, call them whatever you want, but the professional essentially, and the parent. And when I say parent, I mean parent in the broadest sense, whoever the child lives with when they're not going to a nursery, you know, or earlier setting of some description. So a parent in the greatest sense. Now, I say that because it's really important to acknowledge the role of the people who the children or the child lives with, as well as those people inside the early years setting. And it has to go in tandem. But obviously the child is at the center of that. So the characteristics, really, there is sort of like steps that I suggest that are part and parcel of those characteristics. But often what I talk about is the permission from the parent, but it's unwritten permission. You know, when a child starts at nursery, you will go through, you know, the proprietor will go through all sorts of things about, you know, the children's likes and dislikes and so on and so forth. But they're not going to say, can we love your child? Because, you know, that's not something that's going to be discussed in that way. However, my argument is that when the setting is set up in a way that fosters authentic relationships between children and adults professionally and within the context of their family, then over time they build up a relationship that becomes natural and normal. Well, that is natural and normal, obviously, but it's built on that capacity to get closely in tune with the child in a way that is accepted by the parent and is not undermining of their role, and is intended so that the parent doesn't feel that they are somehow taking the love away from their child for them. And that's quite complex. So it's beyond that sort of binary position of, you know, oh, well, we all love the children here, or yes, of course, we love Molly, David, or whoever. It's actually quite complex within the context of that, because it's very much around those unwritten permissions that I think I could relate to back in my day when I was a practitioner, that I think you can see if you've got good systems set up in nurseries or earlier settings where there is a culture of respect and an ethos of values, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, yeah, yeah. What struck me as well is that what initially sounds fairly straightforward, that idea of professional love as a heading, if you like, or as a phrase, the further you get into it, the more complex it becomes. And therefore, I think it's such an interesting thing to discuss, but also such an interesting thing to research. Something that it made me think about was sort of thinking back to my early career. And it's that sort of, I wondered whether actually your research had shown a kind of a difference in relationships between adults and children in terms of what role the adult played within the setting. The reason I asked that is that I can think back to sort of my early time in as part of my career, where for myself as the teacher, I was there within the early years setting. This was in an early years unit, so we had reception and nursery children together, quite a large unit, and I had a number of members of staff who I worked with as well. But we also had a lady who was really, she was wonderful. She was really, really interested in working with early years children. And she's actually very well qualified, and she was a parent of children at the school, and she used to come and help by coming along and helping every Wednesday afternoon. She would come along, and for the afternoon she would spend time with the children. Okay, and I learned such a lot. It sounds such an odd thing to say, but I learned such a lot from watching somebody who wasn't attached in quite the same way as I was to the children in the class, in that I had a particular relationship with the children in the class as the teacher at this point. And this particular lady, she came along, and within seconds, the children would gather around her. She'd walk in and they would come to her, and she would be down at their level. She would be crawling around on her hands and knees. She would be joyful. She was an expert co-player, in a way that at that point, I definitely hadn't done that before. You know, I since learned to do that, but I hadn't done that. And so I wondered, it just made me think, as part of the research, did you notice a difference in terms of relationships between adults and children, depending on the roles of the adults?
Yes, indeed. And I think that what you've just described is really fascinating. And what I saw in my research that I carried out in 2015, whereby to an extent, if an individual doesn't have perhaps some of the constraints of, you know, curriculum and policy and procedures and all of those things that, you know, obviously as leaders and managers and experts that one has in those roles, can feel a little bit sort of daunting, because it takes you away from the children in ways that perhaps you don't intend to, but actually you have to do other things as well. When those things are not there, it's kind of like sort of shaking the shackles off sort of thing, and being able to be your authentic self, And I think that being your authentic self is really important. And I think children are so clever. They know when we're being our authentic selves and they know who they feel comfortable with. Now, of course, we work with, in the context of the key person approach. And I think when the key person approach works well, and I'm well aware of the constraints of early year settings and, the long days that staff have to work. But when they have a buddy system or something that works really well, then there is an opportunity for the staff to get close, to get up and close and personal. And so what I'm advocating is rather than keeping distance, because in the past, or, we do know that there is a narrative that says it's more professional to keep your distance. What I'm saying is the opposite, that actually you have to go into that with the child. You have to go into that space and you have to become your authentic self. So you're going into that. Now, the danger of that, Andy, there are lots of cautions that I would add to that. So firstly, it has to be absolutely with the child's needs at the centre. This is not about adults meeting their needs. This is not about seeing children and whisking them up into your arms because, you want them to do that with them. Now, that's fine in a family context and, all the things that one might do at home. But actually, as professionals, we have to always be thinking. And I think that's why the theory is so important, because we have to think about things. So we have to think about what's right for children. So always the child should be at the heart of that. Some children would like to have physical contact. Some children don't. Some children, there would be good reasons why that's not appropriate. So it's incumbent on the adult to ensure that they are knowledgeable enough about those children and knowledgeable enough to know that the intimacies of that child, the things that they like and they don't like, the things that they are, when the best time of the day for them is. Now, you can only do those things if you make strong relationships with children, and you can only do that over a period of time. It doesn't happen in a split second. So that's why I think when we can make those enduring relationships with children, and when I've seen it work well, that actually what happens is that we start to see those examples of professional love in the way that I would conceptualize it. So it's really about being self-reflective. And I think that's hugely, hugely important. And I think it's hard to be self-reflective sometimes. And also to be resilient, emotionally resilient. Now, I think the challenge of that is for many early years professionals is that emotional resilience is not always high for themselves. And there is research out there done by, many others. I stand on the shoulders of giants, obviously, who have gone before me, who have shown us that often it's the least qualified people in earlier settings that work with the youngest children. And that worries me, because often they might be the people who are the least emotionally resilient. And so therefore, it's quite difficult for them to be able to put the needs of the child ahead of their own. Now, it might be quite subtle, and it might be, one might think, well, what's wrong in just, seeing a child and giving them a big hug? And there's nothing wrong with that if it's what the child wants. But you have to look for those subtle cues from the child. And they are quite subtle. So it takes, I think, an enormous amount of courage and tenacity and that emotional resilience to be able to really understand what that looks like in different children. But we can't all do that for everybody. So we have to make close relationships with one or two or three or four children. And that emulates what Bowlby talks about in terms of attachment theory. And children know who they like. They know who they want to go to. And your example is a really good one. Children will go to the people that they feel comfortable with. And my argument about all of this is, Andy, that there are concerns, because some people have told me that, well, this is all very well, but, we could be accused of doing something wrong if we're spending too much time with one or two children. We're going to be accused of, something to do with child protection or safeguarding, or that basically we're just not doing enough of the other jobs that need doing. And so my message around those things are that, A, there has to be an early years setting approach that gets these things out in the open and has an open dialogue about what's acceptable and what's not, which is why it's not for me to say to a setting, this is what it looks like in your setting. You have to show me. It's got to be the other way around. And secondly, my argument, and I do feel incredibly strongly about this, is that if we don't show children what is normal and natural and healthy, then how will they know what isn't? And for somebody who is going to want to do something to them which is unnatural and unhealthy.
Yes, absolutely. In a way, it's protecting them by showing them how what a warm, affectionate relationship looks like, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's the appropriateness of that relationship. And it will be different for different children and it'll be different for different adults. Some adults wouldn't necessarily want to be hugging children. They wouldn't feel that that was right for them. So it has to be a two-way street, but it's always got to be with the child at the heart of that. So there's got to be an awful lot of self-reflection and emotional resilience. And also, in my view, has to be a way in which we can have that critical dialogue with each other, which can be quite a challenge in an early years setting. If somebody is spending a long time with, you know, a child and you feel a bit stressed because there's so many other things to be doing, there has to be a mechanism for discussing that, which is not always easy.
Yes, absolutely. And it sort of takes me back to that sort of key person role, and that actually different people will take different things from what that role is, you know, and almost assume different things as part of it. Some people will really build strong, affectionate relationships with the children, those warm relationships. Other people will see it as almost like an administrative kind of role of, well, actually, these are the children that I've got to make sure are doing okay kind of thing. And that yeah, it becomes more complicated, doesn't it? Because you're looking at the children's needs in a wide variety of different ways, but you're also looking at the adult's needs and the adult's perceptions in a wide variety of different ways. And so you could go off in so many different tangents. I'm sure you probably did as part of the research. As soon as you kind of almost sort of ask one question, there's then another 10 questions following on from it, I would imagine, which is what I think makes this so interesting.
Yes, that's right. And I think that's why I think it took me so long to say, well, you know, this is what it is. But I think that what I've tried to do now is to, as I say, to set out those characteristics and say that if you can go through these steps, and if you think that you're doing that, then you could argue that this is a form of professionally loving practice, in which case you can call it that. If you're not doing that, doesn't mean to say that you're a bad practitioner. It might mean that you're just offering a really good, high quality experience, but it's not conceptualized like that. And that's fine. You know, it's not for me to judge. I'm not there to judge what others are doing. But what I do hear from the sector is they want more advice. They want more help to be able to do this in a safe way for children. And keeping children at arm's length is not the answer. It's not the answer for children. And we already have a mental health crisis on our hands, you know, due to the pandemic and other factors. And we know that children were, particularly that cohort that were born in the pandemic and are living through that, you know, sort of post-pandemic and stage, you know, they need to know what those markers are and what's safe and what's okay and whatever. And that's why the adults who are in their home lives have to be part of that conversation. They're not going to be in the setting when that's taking place, but there needs to be a way of having those authentic discussions with families that are, you know, can be difficult, of course, but they need to be true. And I think that's a really hard thing to do for early years staff. I don't know if I can give you an example of what I mean there. So sometimes what happens when children go into nursery and families will have their own views about returning to work. Some people will be, you know, absolutely fine about it. It's what they want to do. No issue. But they'll have their own thoughts about what their expectations are of the setting. Other families will feel aggrieved because they don't want to do this, but, you know, they've got to leave their children for long periods of time. So there'll be a variety of different ways in which families will come to that decision and the ongoing sort of reflections about that. And of course, that changes daily. And depending on how many adults are involved in the family setup, there could be different permutations of that. So that's quite hard for early years practitioners to, you know, acknowledge within that. However, I think what goes on sometimes is through everybody trying to do the right thing. But the example I'd like to give is that when children first learn to walk or talk, naturally, the family want to be the person who sees all of that happening. And they want to be there, you know, the parent wants to be there when they say their first word or when they take their first step. Now, in my experience, Andy, what happens is that, not all the time, but what can happen is that the parent knows that that child is probably going to say their first word soon, or they're going to take their first step. The staff at the nursery know that this is going to happen as well. And there's a little thing that goes on where everybody's not quite sure where this is going to happen. Lo and behold, the child takes their first step or says their first word in the nursery. And the staff think, oh gosh, you know, we can't say anything because the parents are going to be crushed by that because they want it to be with them. So at the weekend, the child goes home and the parent comes back on the Monday and they say, oh, you know, Millie started walking over the weekend. They say, oh, how fantastic. Oh, brilliant. But actually they're holding this when, oh, actually they did it last week, but I don't know how to tell you that. Now, everybody's doing that for the absolute best of reasons. But what I would like to advocate in that is that if there is a way to have a conversation with families that says, oh, Millie's nearly there with the walking. Now, if she takes her first step in the nursery, do you want us to tell you, or would you like to wait until she does that with you, knowing that she might have done it here first? What would that look like for you? Now, some parents will go, I don't want to know if she takes it here, I don't know. But you're kind of starting that conversation. But to me, that seems more authentic because children know when you're not being authentic as well. And once they start to learn to talk, if you're starting that at that age, later on when things happen, children will contradict us and they'll say, no, that didn't happen like that. You know, and you'll say, that sort of thing. And these are not bad things. Nobody's doing anything to upset anybody. But it's that little sort of dance that we all do to try to, when actually everybody knows that something different has gone on. So I think that it's not that the staff or parents, you know, start off on that journey wanting to be inauthentic. But I think to take that step into authenticity does take an awful lot of tenacity and courage and will only come when the relationship is enduring and there is a strength in that relationship. So, you know, that's going to take time and it's going to be different for each family. But it seems to me that that's an example of how that can be, you know, approached.
Yeah, it's about trust, isn't it?
It is, and, yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And as you say, being authentic. And it means that it's much more likely to go the other way then, doesn't it? So that the parent is then much more likely to say, you know, on a Monday morning, perhaps, do you know, we've had a really difficult weekend. Or you know, the children have been poorly. Everybody's been tired. We've been really grumpy or whatever it might be. Because actually you've opened up that conversation where it's fine to be honest. Nobody's judging you and so on. And it probably means that you're going to get much more out of that relationship over time, I think.
Absolutely.
Really.
And as you say, I think that then when there are hiccups along the road, then actually it's possible then to work through those because we know that relationships are messy. They're messy in every walk of life, you know. But I think there is more opportunity then to trust one another. And of course, you know, the challenge in particular with this is that it would be very easy to overstep the mark. So I think that constantly thinking about what you do is really important. And again, another example that I tend to give around this is it's a little bit like learning to drive. When you first learn to drive, you do everything in quite an exaggerated way, right up until the day of the test when you're sort of, you know, you're looking over your shoulder in an exaggerated way, then looking in the mirror and you're having to take the handbrake off and do all of those things. You have to think really, really carefully about it. And then after a while, you become much more adept at it and everything becomes more natural and you do things, you know, in a sort of a fairly automatic way without having to think all the time, gosh, you know, I now need to put the handbrake on or whatever it happens to be. However, that doesn't take away the fact that that car that you're getting into every day has the possibility that it could be a very dangerous tool, if you like. It could hurt somebody if you do something incorrectly. But most people don't go out every day and get into their car and say, I'm getting into my killing machine today. They don't think like that. But we do need to check with ourselves sometimes, you know, the weather changes or a warning light comes up on your dashboard. We have to remind ourselves, actually, I've got a responsibility here as a driver. I need to check in with myself that I'm doing these things in an appropriate way. And I think similarly, with professional love, I'd like to think that, you know, once practitioners become more familiar with the idea of it, but actually that thinking continues. So that's why I think the critical dialogue and the self-reflection is such an important part of ensuring that actually this is being done in a way that is safe and appropriate for children. Because if we don't check in, then we're going to be guilty of just doing something because, you know, this all feels okay and it's all jolly and it's all fine. And actually that's when things can go wrong.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The other thing that strikes me about this is that whilst we're talking about professional love as a specific thing, that is as one part of practice, of course, particularly within early years practice, it's more pretty much everything is very much holistic. And so whenever you talk about one part of it, there is a knock-on effect for everything else. Or when children learn in one particular aspect, they're learning about all sorts of different things all at the same time. And the interconnected nature of early years practice means that actually when we're talking about professional love and about warm relationships and about the impact of that closeness and that warmth, is that actually, you know, it has a knock-on effect for learning across the board. But specifically, I was thinking about communication and language skills, that actually, you know, particularly since the pandemic, you know, there's been such a lot of focus on communication and language. And quite rightly so. You know, we know it's important. We know that talk is important. We know that children's communication and language skills underpin learning right the way across the board and so on. At the same time, we also know that if you as an adult are going to support children in terms of communication and language skills, you actually need to have done all of this stuff that we're talking about first of all. Otherwise, if you go and try and have a conversation with a young child when they don't really know you that well and they're not expecting you to be there, they will give you the cold shoulder in seconds. They don't hang about. They will move away. They will decide that they're not wanting to be near to you. They will walk away. And that happens. And it's just listening to you talk, I wonder whether we've connected the two together enough in that conversation. We talked a lot about, in the last few years, talk and communication and language skills, but have we linked it to the warm relationships that we're talking about here? I'm not sure. Does that make sense?
Well, it's really, yeah, it's interesting, Andy, that you should say that because, I mean, I'm a great advocate, you know, obviously for education, of course, but I firmly believe that care and education go hand in hand. You can't have education unless children are cared for and they feel cared for. They feel valued and they feel loved. And, you know, if we go back to the old series of Maslow, for example, we know that sort of, you know, food and heating and all of those sorts of things are really important for children to be able to learn. You know, it's no surprise that we have breakfast clubs and all of those sorts of things for children who perhaps don't have those starts in their day. And that's exactly the same with love. If you don't feel that you are valued, that you're loved, then you're not going to feel secure enough to be able to explore your environment. And that's the same for little children and it's same as children get older as they go through their environment, because they're going to retreat back to where they felt safest. So for babies, that's going to be their parent or their early years practitioner as they're exploring their world. And again, for older children, that's going to be the same, you know, 3 and 4 year olds and so on. What's interesting about what you've just said is that I think there is a real deep connection between getting inside the child's world and getting to know them really well and being able to support their learning. So, I've been lucky enough to work recently with a colleague who is a dance artist. So it's a new area of work for me. I hadn't worked with the arts before, but my colleague Liz Clark, who contacted me and said, you know, I do all of these dance classes for, you know, movement groups for children, you know, who are birth to 4 years old. And I think that I'm emulating some of what you talk about when you talk about professional love. So we had quite a long dialogue about it over 2 or 3 years, and we decided that it would be really helpful if we could try and do some work together. So we were very fortunate. So I applied to for a small pot of funding through the University of Brighton, and we were successful. And we carried out a project that this year, actually, in a nursery in London, a very small nursery, just 2 rooms, you know, babies upstairs, 3 and 4 years downstairs, fairly traditional in many ways. But actually what we were able to do was we were able to use the notion of movement as a reciprocal feature of the dance of reciprocity around loving practice. And what we found was that the practitioners in the nursery that we were working in were really, really, really excellent practitioners. They were really cared about the children. They were, you know, there was a really diverse group of children that were attending this nursery. But they were bound up with so many things like speech and language. They knew that the children that needed extra support and so on and so forth. But I think they were so focused on those things that I'm not saying they were unwilling, they were certainly willing, but it would kind of sort of force them into acting in ways that were less natural. So when we were there, Liz used her expertise to say, well, actually, look, if you just follow the child's lead, don't speak to them, just literally copy what they're doing. Now, I don't want to undermine Liz's expertise or what she talks about in her work. But in essence, really, what she was doing was she was letting the child lead and she was demonstrating to the practitioners how they could do this. What was brilliant about it, Andy, what was absolutely brilliant about it was the ways in which we saw those changes in the practitioners. Once they stopped thinking about, oh gosh, I've got to ensure that I build this language in when I'm talking to the children at lunchtime or whatever it happens to be, they suddenly started doing what the child enjoyed doing. So, and then we saw actually the joy on the children's faces and the joy on the practitioners' faces. And what I was then able to talk to them about was, look, if you can do more of this, then you're more likely to get to know the child and be able to then engage them in language, because that will come more naturally than in a forced way. And also you're doing things in a way that the child is enjoying. So there was one child, for example, who was running up and down the room, little boy, about 18 months old, running up and down the room, completely natural and normal. It's what you'd expect children to do at that age. But the practitioner was trying to get him to engage in other activities and things like that. And he didn't want to. He just didn't want to. And we said to her, don't worry about that. Just let him do what he wants to do and you follow him. And honestly, it was like a light switch. You know, that child suddenly came to life. The practitioner came to life. And the joyful exchange that they were having in a very normal and natural setting was absolutely fantastic. And the outcome of that was that trusting relationship, which was already there. I mean, it was the key person who was working with the child or children and was already there, but you started to see some changes. Now, we were only there for a very short space of time, but we have heard back from the manager of the setting to say that actually there's been some changes in their practice. Another example was where, you know, again, a practitioner felt really, really awkward. But when we said, look, copy what the child is doing, and this little boy was sitting on the floor and he was running cars up and down his arm and all these sorts of things. But once he realized that what had happened was the adult had entered into his world. So she had that, what I call motivational displacement. It's that kind of, you know, forgetting about everything else, I'm in your world. I'm shutting off everything else. So she'd shifted her thinking into his world. He suddenly realized what happened at the end of that. And there's a lovely episode where he then leans into her. So it's very much on his terms. So he leans into her and then she wraps her arms around him. But you can see that happening before your eyes. So more examples of that, I think, will then start to see adults being able to support children through those other parts of their learning. Because, yes, of course, you have to have adult-led practice and you have to have continuous provision and you have to have the right environment. But actually, when children can be trusted in that way, then they will show us what they enjoy doing. And then the adult, who is well qualified, very capable, can then start to introduce those ideas in a way that's more meaningful to the child and is more likely to gain those authentic results that I think we're looking for.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's fascinating. I think that element of practice is something that we don't explore enough, is that, as you say, almost like a switch. Being, you know, sort of where actually you kind of, you know, that the adult has then entered into what the children are doing. And it's exactly what I was describing earlier on, you know, the lady that used to come along on a Wednesday afternoon and would literally, as soon as she walked in through the door, she was part of what they were doing. And she just, they knew that she would enter into their world straight away. In a way that perhaps certainly myself and maybe other adults didn't really do. We had maybe other things going on. We were busy. We had other sort of lists of jobs and so on that we didn't quite enter into their world in quite the same way. And you're right. I think it's when you learn to do it and when you can do it, when you give yourself the opportunity to do it sometimes, it changes the dynamics. And it changes the adult role straight away in a way which is where the adult can then once they've built that relationship, or once they've entered into the world of the child then feels like an expert in what they're doing straight away.
Definitely, yeah.
But also the adult can then see where we can then maybe, you know, did you know what that was called? And give a word for what it is that we're doing here in a way that doesn't take it away from the child. The child is still very much the expert and still very much leading it. But actually the adult is subtly using that relationship as a way of moving learning forward as well.
Absolutely.
And I find that fascinating, really.
Yeah. I think the point is that I'd like to make here as well, Andy, is that it's very sophisticated. So it takes high quality practitioners. So people who are highly qualified and capable of doing those things. So that's why I've always argued that we need the best people working with the youngest children. And we know that we have a problem, you know, with recruitment and all of those sorts of things. But part of that, I think, is because there is so much to do and there are so many concerns about children's progress, and we're assessing children and so on and so forth. But are we stopping to think, actually, what's it like for the child? I mean, children don't choose to go into childcare. Adults choose those settings for them. And I think that we make decisions for children all the time, when actually they are more than capable of making decisions for themselves. Of course, we have to have times of the day when this is most suitable. There has to be other organisational features of the day. But if we can trust children to lead what goes on for them, then I think they are more likely to be equipped to become more emotionally resilient themselves, but actually to feel that they are valued. So that feeling that children will get from thinking somebody is interested in what I'm doing, like the lady that you were talking about who came into the classroom, because she wasn't thinking about anything else. She was completely immersed in their world. So it's having that capacity to be able to do that, shift your thinking away from everything else and say, I'm here completely for you in this moment in time. And it feels like a luxury, but actually it's a luxury we can't afford not to give children. Otherwise, we would just have more and more of the same. And children will be herded around doing things which, quite frankly, we have to question who's it for? What's the purpose of it?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so...
The other thing that it made me think of is that I think adults working with early years children, when we have a particular role, either as a teacher or a teaching practitioner or a practitioner in some way, I think we shy away from sometimes that sort of engagement with children where we enter into their world, partly because I think we want to have an element of control and we feel comfortable when we have some sort of control and we know where something is going. Whereas as soon as we are trying to enter into the child's world, we don't know where this is going. But also I wonder whether we feel more self-conscious that we're not really doing our job in those moments. Thinking back to my early stages of my career, what stopped me from crawling around on my hands and knees, kind of engaging with the children the way that the lady that came in on a Wednesday afternoon as a volunteer did? It was probably the thought that actually at any moment the head teacher might come in and be showing some parents around, or, you know, something like that, which I know sounds a bit odd, but I think that's probably what holds us back in some way.
I think you're right. And I'm probably guilty of thinking that sometimes when I was a manager of a nursery, thinking, you know, what's that practitioner doing, you know, lying on that cushion, you know? And I think there's a difference between lying on a cushion, you know, and doing something with a child that is very obvious. But if you're just walking through, you might not get that. But I think why we need theory, and it's why you can't have the practice without the theory, so that actually practitioners can then argue, what they're doing. And so, you know, Ofsted walks in, you know, Ofsted inspector, what on earth is going on in here? As an adult crawling under the table with a child. Well, there's a good reason for that. And if they're able then to put their position forward and explain why that's important for children, then they're going to feel much better equipped to be able to continue that practice. Now, I think the flip side of that is that we have to be careful that adults are supported through this process. And, you know, making sure that good supervision is in place is really important, and something that I'm not convinced that early years centres or early years services, early years settings have in place in a way that is going to be helpful to them all the time. So I think that many people who work in early years will feel burnt out by all sorts of things, you know, not just, you know, the length of the day and the amount of things they have going on and the amount of children. And we know that there are more and more children now with special educational needs and so on and so forth. So, you know, it's a complicated job now. We know that. So even more important that if we are expecting or asking or, you know, desiring adults to get emotionally involved with children in a way that I'm advocating for through the lens of professional love, there has to be a support system in place that supports practitioners through that. Because, of course, when we're asking those to get involved and go into the child and get into the relationship, there is a point where there's a pain involved because that child is going to leave. And that practitioner relationship with that child is going to change. And they might have been with that child for, you know, 2, 3, 4 years or whatever, but that child is going to move on. And of course, that's the stark contrast between being in a family. And so all of that needs to be very carefully navigated. And it's natural and normal for adults to think, well, I don't want to be hurt, so I'm going to protect myself from that. And the way to protect myself is not to get too close to a child or a family in that way. So there has to be good support mechanisms that are not about, yes, of course, we need staff appraisal. Yes, those about, you know, performance measures and so on. But this is about somebody being available, a leader, a manager, somebody who is suitably skilled to be available for staff, to be able to come and sit down and talk about the difficult stuff. So it could be, you know, Mary's been in this week and I found it really difficult because, you know, I haven't been able to give her the attention that she needs because I've needed to be with Harry and Harry needs me more because X, Y, or Z. But I'm really worried about that. And also I know that Mary's mum thinks that I ought to be doing certain things with Mary because I was doing that last week when Harry was off, whatever that looks like, but not in a way that is about staff appraisal, but this is in a way that talks about emotional stuff. Now, there are the different models of that out there. And my colleague, Dr. Peter Alpha, has worked with colleagues on a model of work discussion, which is situated within psychoanalytical theory, which is a particular model of supporting staff in supervision. There are other, obviously, models out there that support staff. But I think in order to expect people to continually builds on relationships, we have to acknowledge that that's burdensome as well. And so therefore there has to be a support mechanism put in place. And I don't believe that that's really in place at the moment in early years. I don't know what your thought is, Andy, about that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't think that's something we talk about enough, really, that idea of firstly, have we got those really close relationships? But then secondly, if we have, what's the impact on the adults moving on from that, and are we making sure we're having the conversations and discussions around that over time? No, I completely agree. I think that's, as I said before, I think the more you look into this, the more you talk about the implications for practice in this way, it becomes huge, doesn't it? It's you don't just change one aspect and kind of tweak it. You're talking about a knock-on effect, a domino effect for actually, you know, how we meet with our teams, you know, how regularly we do that, the types of conversations we have, all sorts of different things that would be part of the practice really moving forward. It's really, really interesting.
Yeah, I think it's a culture shift, really.
Oh, it is. It is a culture shift. Absolutely. It is, definitely. I feel like we could talk about this all day long. I find this really, really interesting. It's fascinating. And I can see why, actually, having done the initial research, you would then get really drawn into this.
Oh, yes.
Because yeah. I think it's really, really, it's important work. It's really, really important work. I don't think we think about this, and I don't think we talk about this in any way near the amount of detail that we probably should. And not just from an emotional point of view, but from a learning point of view as well.
Absolutely. And I think it is the detail that often gets missed, because it's not unusual for people to say to me, oh, yeah, yeah, we practice professional love, Jules. Yeah, yeah, we love the children here. Yeah, absolutely. No problem at all. Yeah, of course we do. And you know, I certainly don't want to undermine that narrative. If there are good relationships and people work together and it works for their setting and everybody's happy doing those things, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about what we've just discussed, which I think is something a little bit different. But I think it does take a whole setting approach. I think it takes a culture shift, and I think it takes that critical dialogue if we want to ensure that it's done safely and appropriately for children and for the adults that are responsible for them.
Yes, absolutely. I love the idea that you mentioned earlier on of it being like a dance, because I think it is very much like that. You know, that sort of, you know, that the idea of sort of a two-way relationship almost, of a dance, of being aware of the other person, the copying, the mirroring, all of those sorts of ways that we subtly build relationships. So crucial.
Yeah, because it is the minutiae that gets missed, I think. And so when we were in the project, earlier in the year, and as I say, and that's when we talk about dance in that context, we weren't talking about necessarily sort of, you know, dancing in the traditional sense. It was those glances, for example, that that affirmation that somebody has seen and heard. And so that minutiae gets missed. And if that can happen, even if it's for 2 minutes in a child's day, that's going to be topping them up and make them to feel that I have been seen and I have been heard. And we had a really good example of that in our research in the summer, whereby there was a little girl who came to the nursery that we were doing the research in, and she had English as a second language, and she was an afternoon child. So she came in without any difficulty at all. She often came in when the children were in their garden space, she would just smile, and she would, you know, carry on with what she was doing, and the adults would say hello. The children would often be in their friendship groups. But what happened was, Liz and I were discussing it, and I said, it'd be really nice if you could work with her in some way, Liz. And she said, you know, bearing in mind Liz is not the key person, but wanted to just to see whether or not, you know, she could support the staff to work with her, with this little girl in a particular way. And this little girl, we were observing her, and she was picking up a hoop, and she was literally just putting it up over her head and back again. So Liz started to copy her. So she did this for a while. And at first, the child didn't notice. And then she suddenly noticed that Liz was doing exactly the same thing. So she started doing different things and Liz was copying. So the idea was that, with Liz's concept is that you have, you know, the item or something similar that's going to emulate that. So she had her hoop and the little girl had hers. Anyway, over a period of time, and we're talking minutes, you know, we're talking minutes here. This child was literally leading what she wanted to do. And she started to do things. Liz was you know, mirroring what she was doing. What Liz calls it is stepping radically into the child's world, into their space, and just accepting them for who they are. And I think that nature of acceptance for children, regardless of who they are and what they're doing, is really important. And this went on for, I suppose, 10 minutes, absolute max, probably less than that. I think it's about 8 minutes. But what was fascinating was that the adults really, you know, the other practitioners noticed this child came out of her shell and she was doing all these things. Anyway, we captured all of this. But when we'd finished the project, we had an email from the manager of the setting to say that actually what had happened was the parents of that child had said to the manager that the child had changed after that experience, and they'd suddenly changed, become much more open and willing to take part in things. And actually she'd started to speak, and because up until that point, she hadn't really wanted to use language in any way. And they noticed a change in her. Now, you could say there's lots of different things that would have happened in the nurseries that I'm sure that would have contributed to that. But those parents felt, and we hadn't actually met the parents, felt that it was because of our project. Now, that's enormous.
It is. It's huge.
You know, for a parent to recognise that from a little project that we did, this real shift in that child. But I think it was purely because we had worked in her in a different way that showed her that she was valued and her presence was important and she was important. And that's not to say those practitioners didn't think that already, but perhaps she just didn't feel it. So I think it's the feeling that evokes for the child as well.
And it's different levels of it, isn't it?
It is,
a completely different conversation, really, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah.
It's fascinating, Jules. It's absolutely wonderful to talk to you. We'd better start to draw things to a close, if that's all right. But just before we finish, where are you now with the research? Or, you know, bring us up to date. We've gone right from the very beginning of your journey with Professional Love and where you started with this. Where are you at the moment with it?
Okay, good question. It's been my absolute privilege and honour to be invited to speak at various different for various different organisations, and I've been, you know, to Australia and to other parts of Europe and done talks about it. But essentially, and this might sound a little bit utopian, but I really would like to make a difference to children's lives. And so at the moment, I'm thinking very carefully about what that might look like, whether it's another research project that sort of, you know, takes this a next step further so that we can work with more settings, or whether it's formulating some sort of intervention, training package, call it what you will, that actually means that early years providers can really come on board and to make something of it as they will. I think the challenge is, I think exactly what we said right at the beginning of the podcast, Andy, is that we know that the sector is strapped for cash, and there has to be something that is accessible for them. So finding a way that you can work with settings in an accessible manner, we can have webinars and all sorts of things, but I think what the recent project has shown us is that actually when you are in a setting and working directly with those practitioners makes a huge difference. I'm a firm believer that we actually have to have those building blocks of theory. So any training that, you know, we came up with, and I say we, because Liz and I would like to continue to work together. But any training that we felt was needed, I would very much like to have the theory in there and the reflective practice, but there has to be a balance, because of course it has to be built into the working day. And I know as much as you do that there's little time for training, even if there is the finances there. And nobody wants to stay after work or come in at a weekend. That's not right. So it has to be something that's realistic and as authentic as the model that I'm offering. So I'm really thinking about it at the moment. And I would be really keen to know, well, firstly, what you think, but also what your audience might think about what they might need. I've got some examples of that from my research, but I know that the sector is hungry for help, if you like, to be able to do this in a way that supports children's emotional development.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. I think there are two sides to it, and one is the kind of the authenticity, in that you don't want to lose all of the real quality of what you're talking about here. But at the same time, alongside it, there's the challenge of accessibility in terms of people who are there within a nursery or within an earlier setting, being able to, because there's only so many hours in the day, there are only so many days within the week that actually people can access training or materials. And I think I noticed that, in fact, I was first aware of your work through things like YouTube clips. There are YouTube clips, of course, all about your work and about the dance that you mentioned just before. In fact, I think I watched a YouTube clip all about it. I think that particularly a kind of a newer generation of teachers and practitioners will access training and materials in different ways, both in terms of on social media and, of course, online as well. And I think those sorts of ways of putting a message across in a way which is accessible to people, that they can kind of take it in a bite-sized sort of way, not necessarily a half a day's training or a full day's training, but actually a little bit of time here and there. That drip approach, I suppose, might be something that would work. Difficult to know.
It is difficult to know. I'm delighted that Professional Love appears in the Birth to Five guidance, not the DfE guidance for development matters, but in the sector guidance that was put together by the consortium of early years providers. And I think that's delightful for me. But I think, again, it's people say to me, that's great, but how do we do it? And I think that's the point. It's the how-to. I did create a blended training course that I ran a couple of years ago, which worked really well. And I worked with a group of settings, and that was over a 3-month period. But I still think you need to have that, exactly as you said, that right size, that combination, and so on and so forth. So I think it does take a lot of careful thinking, and I'm not quite sure I've got the formula for that yet. Liz and I are continuing to talk and hope we can work together to create something that continues to bring our two worlds together, because I think there's something quite unique in that. But in a way that's authentic both for our own individual pieces of work. So Liz for her dance and her movement and keeping the very careful messages that she talks about within co-creation that is important to her, and me within the context of professional love and the characteristics that I talk about. So I think, again, making sure that we can bring that together in a way that makes sense, but that doesn't lose the essence, that golden thread that we've been talking about for the last hour or so.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Jules, it's been fantastic to talk to you and wonderful to talk in such depth about professional love and the implications for that in terms of practice, but also the impact of that for children and for practitioners as well. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
That's a pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me, Andy. I've really enjoyed speaking about my work. Thank you.
So there you go. Thank you very much to Dr. Jules Page for joining us for this week's episode of the podcast. A really interesting conversation. There's such a lot there, isn't there? Lots to get us thinking. But also, of course, thank you to you people for listening along as well. We talked about lots of the research that Dr. Jules Page is involved in at the moment. We talked about the YouTube clip as part of the discussion as well. What we'll do is we'll put links into the podcast information so that you can go straight to each of those things, because there's such a lot to explore there. All right. Thank you again for listening. Have a good week, everybody. Take care, and we will see you next time.